So Ruben, you know, just to give you a little background, this whole series, this idea, the ideas behind it is talking about a movie that changed your life. And mm-hmm. I love that you talked about the Oxbow. It's Oxbow, right? Is that how I pronounce it? The Oxbow mm-hmm. incident, a movie I had never seen. And it was such a thrill for me to watch it. So before we kind of delve into that movie, I just want to know what role movies have played in your life. Like, what significance have movies in general had for you?
The significance of movies in my life was very, very important in the sense that they were examples that were presented to us at a time when movies all seemed to need to have una moraleja, something.
A morality.
A morality tale, a lesson. And my mother, my grandmother, God bless them both, we used to live very close to a movie theater in Panama called the Edison Theater. And whenever we lived in a very small, you know, we had like two rooms or something. So it was always crowded. And during the summer, it was very hot. So this movie theater had probably the coldest air conditioning unit in the Western Hemisphere known to mankind at the time. Yeah. And we could pay a dime and go there and see three movies and una cómica, cartoons and documentaries. And and so we ended up going a lot to the movies. There was we were surrounded by movie theaters. You had the Edison, you had the Variedades on the north side, and then you have El Dorado on the east. So in Teatro Amador. So we used to go a lot to the movies. And I remember my grandmother always telling me, for instance, if we saw a cowboy movie, we saw somebody get hit and go down, and the other guy would wait for the guy to get up. He wouldn't hit him in the floor.
Yeah.
And I would
There's
ask
a moral
my grandma,
code.
And I asked my grandmother why, and she said, you know, because that you're not supposed to hit people on the when they're down. You know, that sort of thing. So yeah, there were a lot of lessons that we learned. Some of them were good, and some were bad. For instance, the fact that at the time there were no blacks in the films.
Kidding.
Really, they weren't around unless they played certain roles, stereotype roles. The porter or the shoeshine guy or the waiter or the server or something. The fact that there weren't many women in roles of power. Also, the fact that... you know, we applauded when the army, the cavalry came and killed the Indians. You know, it's like
they were the bad guys. Yeah.
So there were things that formed you and also helped to deform you. But I remember the good ones, the good examples, and the Oxbow incident was one of them.
I don't know if you're familiar with Fred Rogers or Mr. Rogers.
Sure.
Well, when he accepted his daytime, lifetime acceptance, daytime Emmy, he did this amazing thing with the audience where he asked everyone in the audience to take 10 seconds to think about everyone that had brought them to that point. And I'm not going to ask you to do that, but I am going to ask you to take 10 seconds and just close your eyes and think about the Oxbow incident and the first time that you saw it, how old you were, where you were, all the memories that come to you, and then I'll chime in after 10 seconds. So where were you transported to then?
I was in Panama. I mean, I saw that film with my parents. With my grandmother. I think I saw it. I don't think I saw it at the Edison. I think I saw it at the Variedades Theater. It was a movie. Remember, in Panama, we didn't see movies necessarily when they came out the same year. You just saw films whenever
they came to you.
Yeah, because I mean, it wasn't like today where movies apparently have a ledge life. You know,
exactly. It's like 2 weeks and that's it.
Yeah, if you don't see it in 2 weeks, then it goes to television. But in those days, we had no television. So there was no TV. So films would be recycled. And if if the movie came in the 40s and you were too little, the movie certainly will come back in the 50s. It would come. That wouldn't come alone. It wouldn't be a premiere. It would come in with something else, with another movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then you forget about the film, and then maybe you rediscover it when you're 14, somewhere else. But again, it's always the same circle. Whether it is in the movie theater, those movie theaters that I mentioned, or another movie theater like the Roosevelt Theater, which was located in San Francisco. You know, so...
Do you remember how old you were, or approximately how old, or what year it would have been when you saw this?
If I saw it with my grandmother, I must have been anywhere between 3 and 5 first. And I saw it again, probably I was 14.
Wow. What do you remember?
I remember that I was young.
You were young, yeah. No, sorry, you remember that you were young.
I remember I was in school. I remember I was in school. And it was an important thing because those were elements that ended up, I think, with other influences, such as personal influences like my grandmother and my mother, my father, and of readings, book readings that I had, like books that I had read, which ended up... pushing me towards law.
That's amazing.
And I think the Oxbow incident was one of those.
It's so interesting to me because when I was, you know, as I mentioned to you, I'd never seen this movie before you recommended it. And watching it, I looked up kind of to see what people wrote about it at the time when it came out in 1943. And it was interesting that the New York Times review of it, have you read the New York Times review of the
yes.
movie? Oh, do you remember this line? It says, "It's hard to imagine a picture with less promise commercially."
Yeah.
And it exhibits most of the baser shortcomings of men: cruelty, bloodlust, sordid pride. It shows a tragic violation of justice with little backlash to sweeten the bitter distraught. And then it says, "The Oxbow incident is not a picture which will brighten or cheer your day, but it is one which for sheer stark drama is currently hard to beat."
And also there was another gentleman who was incensed by the movie. I remember there was a review that just panned it, said it was a horrible movie.
Yes, yes.
And how they waste their time doing such a movie with such horrible premise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because those are the people who feel that art and or film or painting or music or anything just has to be directed towards escape.
Yeah, to entertain.
Escapism and entertainment, basically, and not used for any other function. And it's interesting that now the Oxbow incident is one of the 100 films. I mean, it's certainly the Western film noir of all time, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And it's such a quiet movie, right?
It
has so much power. And so in many ways to me, it feels of that era, but it also feels so timeless.
It is, and that's what makes these films eternal. I mean, the fact that they knew how to present the conflict of a specific time in ways that were objective enough to serve as a model of current of future times, and some great films have that. That power, the Oxbow incident, it was one of them. 12 Angry Men is another.
Oh, yes, another one. Yeah.
You know, I could have gone either way. I mean, and there was another one called
Henry Fonda.
The other one was called The Wrong Man.
Oh yes, The Wrong Man.
I remember that, and they all revolved around the justice, the argument about justice, which is. It played a tremendous influence in my decision to become a lawyer.
Yeah, I mean, the Oxbow incident speaks to so many important issues. I mean, the idea of right and wrong, what happens when a vigilante mob mentality is allowed to enact justice.
And how quickly we jump
yes.
to conclusions.
Yes.
You know, I mean, everything about it, they had Kincaid's cattle. Kincaid that day, he didn't give him a bill of sale.
Exactly.
The Mexican had Kincaid's gun. I mean, every single thing pointed towards the possibility that these men effectively had done what they were being accused of doing.
Hmm.
But the pride of that man, who probably also had a grudge because he had lost, his side had lost the Civil War.
Yeah.
And
had his own pain with it.
Yeah, he wanted to exert revenge to some degree on these people. You know, so, I mean, it was Dana Andrews, who played the
Donald
the
Martin
cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, he was just...
He's amazing. Oh, my God.
It was one of the best roles. He also was in Laura. He played
oh,
a detective.
I didn't realize he was in Laura, yeah.
Yeah, he played a detective. You know, he's one of those guys that he was also in the best years of our lives.
Yes.
He quietly did very nice work. He just mm-hmm. was not ever elevated at the same level of a James Stewart or a Henry Fonda. But he was very, very effective. And he was so decently portraying this man that was subjected to such a horror.
Yeah. I mean, he's the conscience of the movie, right? I mean,
yes, he is.
I think about what he says to the mob. This is a moment that, oh my God, it really struck me down when I saw it. Right before they hang him, he sums up one of the big questions and lessons that the movie asks us to reflect on. He says, "Justice, what do you care about justice? You don't even care whether you've got the right men or not. All that you know is that you've lost something and someone's got to be punished."
Absolutely.
And I'm curious, you talk about how this influenced you as a lawyer. What lessons did you learn and carry from that movie that really led you?
The need that justice must be, that the ideal must be defended in order for it to exist. It's not enough to speak about justice. You really have to enforce it. You have to be a part of its defense.
Hmm.
And that people that are not given justice are abused just the same way that I would be abused if I don't have access to it.
Hmm.
So I felt I wanted to be on the right side of history. I mean, I saw that and I suffered. It pained me. Hmm. To experience what those men had experienced.
Hmm.
It's just as if they hung me or a part of me as well that day. You know, it's like, and it was irreversible.
Hmm.
That's another thing that affected me. I thought, gosh, when this happens, people are totally without any type of protection. They just succumb. That's it.
Yeah, that's it.
And I thought, well, the system has to make people aware of our own capability of being wrong, and not to take the law by our own hands. I mean, I don't know. I wish, and it was interesting also that both James Stewart and Harry Morgan's characters, they did not approve.
Oh, Henry Fonda and Harry Morgan.
Yeah. I think it was James. Wasn't it James Stewart?
No, it was Henry Fonda.
It was Henry Fonda.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I see James Stewart in that role.
Well, he looks so young, and I think he's very, it's a very atypical Henry Fonda role, so I understand
yeah,
why.
Well, yeah, well, again, the three roles that I mentioned, that they're all Henry Fonda.
Exactly.
12
Angry Men, The Wrong Man.
The Wrong Man and this one. But they didn't, you know, they really didn't stop it.
Hmm.
They just didn't think it was right.
Yeah.
They didn't think it was right, but they didn't stop it. So in a way they were as guilty as the men who made it, who did it.
Yeah.
And again, this is a situation where people who are not actively supporting the misdeed actually become accomplices of it for not saying anything. That was another thing that I remember that I got out of the film. I mean, you have to talk about it. You have to be a part of it. You have to denounce it. You have to accept that you're wrong or accept wrong.
Yeah, and speak up in the moment.
And they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
They did not, because they felt they didn't have all the information, that they could have been wrong. And although they did not approve of it, they ended up joining the wrong.
Mm.
And I remember feeling about that and thinking, well, how many times do we do that?
Yeah.
Every day. Mm. You know?
We hold back from speaking up for someone, something that we see is wrong. Yeah.
Because we're afraid. We're afraid of being wrong, and we're afraid of consequences.
Mm.
And we say, well, actually, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It could be.
Yeah.
But the point there was not about whether or not they could have murdered Kincaid. The thing there was, you're not supposed to hang people without a fair trial.
Exactly.
That's the point. And they were not, strong enough in opposing that.
Yeah. And that's why when the scene where the sheriff comes upon the mob and he says, Larry Kincaid's not dead. I mean, that scene just gave me chills.
Yep. I remember, because, and this is the other thing with the audience, is that we don't know what happened until he shows up.
Until he shows up and says that, we don't know.
Because it could have been.
Mm.
It could have happened. So it was such a smart, I mean, this movie was so smart in so many ways, because whenever you see a film and you see in those days, and even now when you see a film and you see like the headliners, the names, you know?
Yeah.
Henry Fonda, Harry Morgan, you know they're not going to die.
Anthony Quinn, which I always forget,
Anthony Quinn, it's an interesting, you know how his role was described as?
No, how?
Mexican. He didn't even have a name.
Well, and it's funny because he keeps saying no sabe instead of no sé, which I was like, is that on purpose? Why is he saying no sabe, no sabe?
Yeah, well, at the time, I think a lot of times they did things like that so the audience would understand what he was saying.
Oh, yeah.
No sabe is what a North American would say.
Instead
of, he doesn't know how to speak English. Yeah, I mean, Spanish.
Spanish, yeah.
So, he was just Mexican, and the role was described as Mexican. He was great.
Oh, so great.
And again, he did a lot with very little.
Mm-hmm.
It's just to give you an idea of where he was going.
His facial expressions. Oh, yeah.
He's the only person of Mexican background, although he was U.S., and who's won the Oscar for supporting actor twice.
Hmm.
He won it for Lust for Life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he
won it.
Where
he was Pablo Picasso, right?
He played Paul Gauguin.
Oh, Paul Gauguin.
And Kirk Douglas played Van Gogh.
Van Gogh,
Vincent,
that's who
Van
it is.
Gogh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he won again. I think, I don't remember what the second role he won it for, but he's the only one.
Did he not
win
it for Zorba? Zorba the Greek.
No, he didn't win for Zorba. Zorba, he should have won for Best Actor.
Uh huh. Yes.
I think. I don't want to say Viva Zapata. It might be that.
It might be that actually. That sounds right. Yeah.
He probably won it for Viva Zapata. But anyway, the fact that they put these main roles in an ambivalent position, they weren't heroes.
Yeah.
Henry Fonda was not a hero in this movie, and neither was Harry Morgan. So the hero was the guy who died, who was abused.
Yeah.
So that was very, very interesting, because it created a... And the audience also, I believe, a higher impact.
Hmm.
Because we tend to identify with the heroes.
Yeah.
So in this particular case, you couldn't identify with the heroes and be happy, because the heroes did not act heroically.
Yeah.
They just let...
Which is so counter to Westerns of that time, right? Where there was a very clear hero.
Yeah. Movies in general, because again, what I learned, it was precisely not to act like they did.
Hmm.
What I learned was to act differently,
hmm.
And that was it's a very interestingly different lesson that you derive from actors who usually portray heroes that are supposed to be imitated.
Yeah.
In this particular case, your hero actors did not portray heroic figures in the roles.
You know, my favorite scene in the movie comes right before the very end when Gil Carter, who's played by Henry Fonda, he reads that letter that Donald Martin wrote to his wife, right?
Yep.
Right before he was hung. So he reads it to the men in the bar after everything has happened. All the men go to the bar to drink.
Yeah.
And it's such a powerful scene because all we hear is Gil reading the letter. There's no music. There's nothing to manipulate us. Just the words.
Another great choice. Another great choice. And in today's sensitivities, you know, somebody might just come up with this incredibly, you know, huge orchestra.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
In this particular case, I mean, it was just, and that's the dignity that I believe the director, Conrad, I think was his name, actually.
It's William Wellman.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Wellman, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. He decided to keep it real.
Yeah.
And trust this audience. He didn't feel that the audience had to be manipulated into, cued into, like, feeling, you know, as many movies today do.
And it's more powerful because of it.
Absolutely. It was really interesting when you're in a movie theater. I don't know. I don't think it happens now. Or maybe it does. I don't know. Because I think the audiences have become more cynical. But I remember when I saw the movie, I remember in the theater, in the hushed, completely silent, blackout theater, people sobbing.
Hmm.
You could actually go to a movie in those days and have an audience participation. People cry. And laughed and talked back to the screen and. I don't see much of that now.
Yeah.
I think people do talk a lot now because they think they're home.
Exactly. But in a very different way.
Yeah, not in a constructive way.
No. Well, it's because the movie was the center of your universe in a lot of ways. That was where you went to be together, other than church.
But also, yeah, absolutely. And also because it was a place that was respected.
Mm.
It was a poor man's opera. You went there and you sat down and you behaved. Today, people have, you know, they're talking about personal stuff, you know, right behind you.
Mm.
And answering the phone and talking. And you know, it's like, I don't go to the movies that much anymore.
Yeah, it's understandable why. So, I mean, I mentioned that was one of my favorite scenes in the film, previous to last scene. And I wonder, what are the scenes that really stand out for you when you think about this movie?
The same ones you mentioned.
Yeah. I mean, we're on the same page.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember that scene that you mentioned in the bar when he speaks. I remember how angry I got every time that sort of Confederate general, whatever he was.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Ex-general talked, the hatred he had, the way he treated his son.
Yes. Major Tetley. Oh, he was horrible.
It was Ed.
Let's just say when he kills himself, you're glad. You're glad he's killed himself.
Well, yeah. I mean, he showed some compunction, I guess.
Hmm.
I don't know. I mean, he felt guilty or I don't know what he felt, actually, because.
Probably embarrassment. I think about. He kills himself after his son confronts him finally and tells him that truth.
It was Ed Begley, was it? Ed Begley?
Who's the general?
Yeah.
Frank Conroy.
Frank Conroy.
Yeah,
gosh,
who I don't
know. I
got
all my guys mixed up.
Well, I mean, you have a lot in your head. Come on.
No. It's just that I'm thinking about a lot of different films. Begley was in 12
Angry
Men.
Men.
He was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I just, to me, that's those three films are like so tied up.
They shaped you.
Yeah, they're so tied up. I mean, Henry Fonda and The Wrong Man is a musician that just happens to look like someone who committed a crime, and
yeah,
and all these circumstantial situations that all sort of get together and then end up bringing him to this really horrible place. I mean, and he's assumed to be guilty, and it's like he goes through all of this stuff. And 12 Angry Men, Fonda is the one juror that says, that votes no. I'm not sure about this. Whereas in the Oxbow incident, he doesn't believe that this is certainly the truth. And he recommends, you know, we should wait or whatever, but he's not strong enough.
He doesn't stop it.
To stop it, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, all those things that you were mentioning, I remember Anthony Quinn also, he got shot and he didn't complain about it.
At all.
He allows the bullet to be taken out with no
anesthesia. Which I felt a lot of pride. I'm like, as a fellow Hispanic, I'm like, that's
himself.
Right.
He actually takes a knife and does it himself, which I thought was really great to have that shown a character from a minority.
A Mexican man to be the bravest one in some ways.
He just took it. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting.
Accustomed to being violated in so many ways that he didn't feel that this was any different.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, it's interesting you're talking about those three films, The Wrong Man, 12 Angry Men, and The Oxbow Incident. And when I think about your career, I mean, I grew up listening to your music and being inspired by you as an activist, as someone who fights for what is right, and talks about what's wrong in your music as well as in your law and your politics. And I think about so much of your work being about that justice, right? That seeking justice for people who've been wronged, about how often we are judgmental towards one another.
And how many times we are quiet about it.
Yes, and how many times we are quiet. And it's no coincidence to me that you've been the opposite of quiet, right? You've stood up and spoken and used your voice in every possible way.
I don't portray myself as a hero. I was just upset. I was just angry, actually. I remember, for instance, I was a part what I believe, and people will correct me, but I believe it was the first national documentary on AIDS. It was, I believe, in 1985. It was PBS. It created a lot of backlash. For one, many people felt that it didn't go far enough to denounce what was going on. I think that PBS did what it could at the time. And one of the most important things that it did, that documentary, was to defend the notion that this was a health epidemic.
Yeah.
It was a health problem. It was not, as it was being categorized at the time, some sort of divine punishment against a specific group.
Yeah.
And which led many people to turn their backs on what was going on. PBS chose to address the issue as a public health situation, and the gay community felt that was not enough, and I guess that both sides had arguments that could defend both positions. I participated in it because I felt I wanted to bring, you know, to the forefront what was going on a national scale, and all of us, the three of us who participated, I mean, I think Ronald Reagan Jr. was one. His father did nothing really.
Yeah, during his presidency,
what was going on, nothing of substance and that I remember. And Beverly Johnson, the model, was myself. And I remember, I mean, I'm sure that, and for Ronald Reagan Jr., it must have been really especially difficult because
of
his father. But we all, I'm sure we all got mail. I got a lot of hate mail saying that, you know, all kinds of things. And also, not just because we were stating the situation as, but also because we were allegedly defending the use of drugs, because we were also talking about the need to the possibility of exchanging needles.
Needles, yeah.
as means of contagion. So we wanted the needles to be provided, and they said that we were encouraging drug use and the gay lifestyle, and you know, and in those days, I mean, you know, you could actually, and even today you can, but in those days particularly, one felt the sort of intolerance that was that I saw in those films. You know, and we're talking about 1985. But this is, and I wrote my songs always from the perspective of denouncing these things and bringing a different opinion, because I always felt that it made people who were feeling those things feel less lonely. That was basically it. I wanted people to know that they were not alone.
And you wanted
that's what I thought.
And I think you gave voice to those who didn't have a voice in your song.
Well, I was one of the people. I mean, other people did a lot much more than I ever did. And some of them were actually killed by the military dictatorships that we were denouncing at the time. Victor Jara in Chile,
Oh, yes.
He got killed by the military.
Yes.
And in Central America, Monsignor Romero got killed. And the Marinol nuns and Rutilio Grande and the Jesuits and you know, there were so many people all throughout in those days in Central America and South America who were being killed for standing up for justice, basically. So, and there were other people writing, Chico Buarque, Caetano Veloso in Brazil, you know, Milton Nascimento. So
Mercedes Sosa.
Mercedes Sosa, absolutely, Violeta Parra. You know, there were so many people writing and Ali Primera, you know, so yeah, but I figured I'm gonna write about that too. And and I'm sure that it was a consequence, just as it was for me to go study law. Part of it was that desire to prevent the sort of things that I saw when I was very young, exemplified in film.
What does this movie give you now when you watch it at this age that's different from when you were 14 or even a five-year-old?
It really just reminds me that the fight is not over. I mean, it just exhibits the fact that we are not out of the woods.
We haven't learned.
No. We have learned, but the need to address those who have not learned continues. It's not unanimous.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, and it's a great thing to, you watch it and you go, wow, the fight is still going on. Because, I mean, we tend to think that, for instance, in the case of President Obama, that because this country elected a black man as president, we were out of the woods when it came out to racism. We're not.
Yeah.
We're not. And it was a wonderful, hopeful, excellent example of this country's prevalence of the its better angels, as Lincoln said once. But the evil angels are still around. I mean, it's
and they're part of us, right?
They are part of us. Yes, they are. All of us. We have to be on the lookout constantly. So we don't fall back. Look what's happening right now with the situation with women and all the scandals with people in Hollywood and whatnot. And in the midst of all this justified rebellion against such attitudes and actions, who's talking about, for instance, making women's salaries the same as men for the same work? Nobody's talking about that.
Yeah.
So everybody's horrified because they
start problems.
But everybody's just like, oh, yeah, it's not right to touch a woman if she doesn't want to. And it's not right to force yourself on a woman sexually, even suggesting, you know, okay, all of that is okay. And it's true. And it shouldn't happen. And let's do whatever we need to. Okay, but what about payment for women who work and do the same job a man? Why aren't they not getting paid the same amount?
Exactly.
That is not being discussed. Have you seen anybody discuss that?
No, not as part of this conversation.
I haven't heard that at all.
No.
I haven't heard that at all, and all the public indignation that we're witnessing right now. So, you know, that makes me think that they don't really care.
Yeah.
People don't really care about these things being faced. You know, we're right now sort of morbidly enjoying the collapse of some idols or powerful people because they were involved in business and that had to do with show business.
Yeah.
But the real issues, not that that other thing is not real, but I'm saying real other irreal issues like the lack of opportunity to advancement in work and the lack of salaries that equal the same work as a man. That those issues need to be looked at, and I don't see that happening.
Mm. Yeah, when as a lawyer, you know.
I may be wrong, but I don't see it happening.
As a lawyer, you know that it's through changing law that change happens, right?
And it's also through example. When I ran for president in Panama in 1994, in the context of our internal laws, I placed the obligation that women would have access to half of positions of command within the structure of the party that we created. Mm. And I had some people criticize me and criticize the action by saying that I was trying to impose women on the party structure. And I said, no, I'm not imposing women. I'm imposing the opportunity for women, which is a different thing. If the woman is not capable, or it's just as a man may not be capable, well, that's something that could be proven. But I'm going to force the opportunity because otherwise it will not be there.
Yeah.
There are things that you can try to do when you're in a position I was in charge from 2004, 2009 of tourism in Panama, and I have 444 people under me. The woman that was in charge of everything that has to do with publicity and related to tourism, she was in charge of a very important part of our industry. In our job, and she was a wonderful Cathy Guardia. She was wonderful worker, and you know, she never had any reason to worry about, you know, some abuse coming on her way because the fish rots from the head down. So if your boss is respectful, then everybody else will be respectful.
Exactly, that's what leadership does.
Yeah, so it's about examples.
Mm.
It's not about talk.
Yeah.
Talk is good. Talk is necessary.
But action. Action really matters.
Yeah. Like I said, I want to see the day when a woman gets the same amount of money. And I'm not saying it in English. I've said it in Spanish also.
Uh-huh.
You know, that a woman gets the same amount of money that a man for the same work. I mean,
exactly.
My mother worked very hard. My grandmother worked all their lives. And I saw them that they did not get the respect and the recognition that their work deserved.
Yeah.
And they were women who were like holding out the house. They were, you know, making sure everybody had, you know, wasn't missing on something.
Exactly.
So anyway,
is there anything else, Ruben, that you'd like to say about Oxbow Incident that I didn't ask you about?
I think that it should be the type of film that people see. I really believe those three movies, Oxbow Incident, The Wrong Man, and 12 Angry Men, are films that people should see. They should be mandatory so that we can get acquainted again with our need to be vigilant so that we do not commit the same mistakes again, especially now, especially in these times, you know, that are so troubling, but at the same time are so promising, I find, because things are being presented for what they are, and that provides us with a perfect opportunity to correct them.
Yeah.
You know, because
one of the... And to speak up.
Absolutely, because one of the problems with racism and sexism and is that it's insidious. You know, it's hidden. It's very well covered. And when it comes out to the forefront, then so be it. So there's a fight. There's a public argument, and I really think we need to talk about these things and have understanding as well. I think it's not just all burn. It's to understand and to think that there is a possibility for our redemption. And you cannot just always blame, because people who always condemned and then will themselves be condemned as well. People who don't know how to forgive will never be forgiven.
It reminds me of the words that Gil Carter writes in his letter to his wife in the movie. He says, "Law is a lot more than words you put in a book, or judges or lawyers or sheriffs you hire to carry it out. It's everything people ever have found out about justice and what's right and wrong. It's the very conscience of humanity."
I recommend this movie to everyone. It should be shown to every school, group. And there are many movies, but I mean, we're talking about this particular
so powerful.
One. And also it was powerful because it was a Western. Remember, Westerns were so popular. Maybe this generation doesn't understand it, but Westerns were so popular.
And they were people saw America, right? I mean, I think about
absolutely.
Latin Americans. I mean, my parents in Colombia, Westerns were what you equated with America.
Absolutely. I saw it in Panama and with the nobility of America.
It was the best of America, yeah.
Absolutely. The immigrants, the people coming in and building something out of nothing and defending justice and simple folk that told the truth and lived simply.
Honor and moral
honor,
code.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. All of those things were the first presentations actually were done by film, even stronger than books. Because I read a lot, too. My grandmother taught me how to read when I was about 5 years old. She taught me in the house. And so, you know, but film is where films like the Oxbow Incident were the ones who brought out originally the sense of justice, of honor, of duty, of fairness. And so they were very, very important then, and they continue to be important today. The thing is that today, these movies really come very, you know, seldom. I mean, everything now is about explosions and sex and I don't know.
Yeah. Well, Ruben, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. Es un honor para mí. I mean, I can't tell you what a voice you've been. Una inspiración para mí, para toda mi familia, mi hermano. Realmente no te puedo describir lo que significas para mí. En serio.
Muchas gracias. Muy amable. Muchas gracias. Un saludo a todos los que nos escuchan. And thank you all for listening to me. I hope I didn't talk too much.
No. You talked the perfect amount. Bueno, un placer. I hope to meet
Muchas
you someday
gracias.
In person.
Gracias. Yeah, I hope so, too. Where are you now?
I'm in Minneapolis, believe it or not.
I played there.
Oh, my. Are you going to be playing here anytime soon? I've actually never seen you in concert. I mean, I've seen Buscando America. I have all your live albums, but I've never seen you in concert.
No, well, hopefully I'll be around. I mean, we're talking about, I'm not sure with which band, but if it's a Latin band or the jazz band. But
oh, yes, the jazz band that you have.
I'll stop by. I mean, Minneapolis, I played there once. And I've always been, of course, a big, very respectful and admirer of Prince.
Yes, our hometown hero here. Uh-huh.
Yeah, God bless him, man. God bless him, and he'll live forever.
He will.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Ruben.
Gracias
por todo. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.